Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with remarks by Australia's Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer that the biggest threat to the world's biggest economy are the cranks and crazies that have taken over the Republican Party. A longtime Republican congressional staffer who was a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, Mike Lofgren, joins us to discuss the possibility of the lunatics taking over the asylum. He is the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Then we will discuss the decision by Hillary Clinton to remove the Iranian dissident group, the Mujahideen al-Haq, or MEK, from the State Department's list of designated terrorist organizations. An expert on the MEK who went to Camp Ashraf in Iraq to study the former terrorist group, Jeremiah Gulka, joins us to explore the lobbying campaign that employed prominent journalists and politicians on both sides, as well as national security luminaries, to delist the MEK, a move that is likely to open the door for congressional funding to carry out attacks inside Iran. Then finally, we'll speak with Michael Desch, a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study at Notre Dame University. He has an article at Foreign Affairs, Bibi's Chutzpah, The Prime Minister Crosses a Red Line. We will discuss the article and the extent to which Israel's Prime Minister has already inserted himself in American domestic politics as he tries to drag the U.S. into another unnecessary war. Joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him a ringside seat on the TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He is the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here.
And I just mentioned the Australia's Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer, who made public remarks this last week that the biggest threat to the world's biggest economy are the cranks and crazies that have taken over the Republican Party. That in itself is pretty unusual for a senior minister in a friendly government to speak in a month or so from the election. And he, of course, is a fairly serious guy who was considered one of the, I think he won a prize from the banking committee for being the smartest treasurer since Australia avoided the 2008 recession. What do you make of those remarks?
Well, first, I wonder what was his first clue? And second, when I wrote the book, The Party Is Over, I sometimes had a sneaking suspicion that I might have been unconsciously overstating things because of frustration and disappointment and all the rest of it building up. But no, the Republicans have managed to give me new material right unto this day. I've just read now in the papers that the chairman of the Alabama Republican Party is now raving over some very obscure birther documentary that says not only was Obama's father not, of course, a American citizen, and thus he was not, he was born abroad. No, that wasn't even his father. It was actually somebody else who was a communist. Apparently the belief is that communist chromosomes are heritable. So there's certainly a lot of craziness there.
So, my understanding, you've identified these two strains, and that is that the plutocrats are trying to drag us back to the Gilded Age, and the theocrats dragging us back to the Salem witch trials. Now, do the plutocrats use the theocrats? Are they just the way that the Democrats used to use the labor unions to get people out to vote and to lick the stamps, etc.? Is that what the modern Republican Party has done? It's made a deal with the theocrats to get the ground troops?
I think that's a very good analogy. The plutocrats are sort of the commanding heights of the party, and the theocrats are the ground troops. Now, why would very savvy and rather financially ruthless people like the Koch brothers fund someone like Michelle Bachmann earlier in her presidential campaign? They don't have too much truck, I assume, with some of her wilder theological theories. However, I believe that since they know that this mobilizes people and that she would have been very supportive of their fiscal and budgetary policies based on that sort of evangelical health and wealth gospel, why not, you know, give her some seed money and see if she goes anywhere?
So, Mark Lofgren, again, you spent 28 years working in Congress as a senior Republican staffer, 16 years as a senior analyst on the House and the Senate budget committees, which gave you a ringside seat on the TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. And, of course, you're the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Of course, it's undeniable and unavoidable that we're having an election here, and it's going to be a $6 billion election. And it's not inconceivable that the crazies will take over the asylum, don't you think? I mean, I think Romney's still got a good chance. There's all the polls put him down, but on the other hand, there's a tremendous enthusiasm gap with the right wing fired up and the left wing asleep. Or petulant and annoyed that the miracle worker turned out to be mortal, it could happen, couldn't it?
I think we're into somewhat uncharted territory this year, because ordinarily, if you have a poll of polls and they all say one thing, they tend to be predictive. However, we have seen in a number of states, the Republican-led legislatures enacting laws that are essentially like poll taxes. And I think the calculation is that if they can shave a half point or a point off the Democratic vote totals, Romney may just be able to eke out a victory. That's in addition to the enthusiasm gap you mentioned. Not that Republican-based voters are particularly enamored of Romney. He's not particularly attractive to him in that way. But since they've created an image of Obama as the Antichrist and as this foreign Muslim in disguise, it's possible that fear is what motivates them to go to the polls.
But you would think, though, given the unprecedented amount of voter suppression that's going on and the unlimited amounts of money that are pouring in through anonymous fronts like these 501c4 charities there set up by the IRS as tax-exempt charities, that's a monumental change that few wealthy donors not only can hide their identities. And by the way, corporations can too. And corporations have always been careful to hedge their bets and give money to both sides because half their customers are Democrats and half their customers are Republicans. Now they don't have to. And these instruments that they've set up are completely, can be disbanded after the election. This goes to a question of strategy, Mike Lofgren. The groundwork for what's happening in this election was laid in the 2010 elections, where people like the American Petroleum Institute put up a ton of money to get all of these state legislatures elected so that that Republicans could control the legislatures in these swing states and enact this agenda. So they've got a game plan. The Democrats seem to be asleep at the switch.
Well, I would definitely say that in addition to vote suppression and the enthusiasm gap, the Citizens United decision is a third big factor. Russ Feingold was talking a couple of days ago And he says, not only is this a disaster, it's worse than he could have expected in terms of simply the flood of money. And I recall a month or two ago, a rather amusing, but not for the reasons some people might think, interview between Nina Totenberg and Justice Scalia, and he was describing the whole Citizens United decision that, of course, money is speech and so forth. And he, in addition, said, but of course, it shouldn't be anonymous. We should know who the donors are. And of course, the interviewer didn't have the, you know, wits about her to ask, well, wait a minute. This has opened up a flood of anonymous money. What are you going to do about it? So there's lots of ironies here in how this whole thing has turned out and how it's a complete disaster for our democracy. Both parties now are beholden, essentially, to big corporate donors. This is an example of there being the capital on the auction block for sale to the highest bidder.
Well, with the exception of Michelle Obama, who spoke to the Congressional Black Caucus and said that the voter suppression was the issue of the day, if you will, harking back to the civil rights struggle to overcome, you know, decades of Jim Crow. Now you just said it yourself that they're effectively reintroducing poll taxes. I still can't figure out, though, why. I mean, in your book, you thought the Democrats became useless. You would think, just out of survival, that they would be able to mobilize their base on the basis of an assault on the fundamentals of American democracy. Or am I being naive?
One would think that, but that's precisely the reason I suggested they had become useless. They've become useless in many ways. Has Geithner, Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, has he been essentially anyone different from Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury of the Bush administration, other than being a bit younger and more hirsute? I don't think so. And if you believe Bob Woodward's book about the debt ceiling crisis, Geithner came to Obama and said, you've got to take the House Republicans' deal, which would have required a completely politically impossible vote just before the election. And not only that, he didn't come with a plan B of what the Treasury might do. Now, for a staffer or advisor to an elected official, from my experience, that's completely unacceptable. I don't know why Obama didn't fire him right there.
So what's your sense then, Mike Lofgren, of who the culprits are here in terms of the lack of attention on the part of the American public to the extent to which anti-intellectualism and anti-science is, and it's got to the point, I think, where there's no consensus anymore about what's true anymore. My sense of it is that the press bears a large responsibility for how much our politics have been degraded, because they're simply incapable of taking a position. Remember, during the debt ceiling, they still have their so-called fair and balanced, one side and then the other, he said and she said, when it was clear that one side was holding the full faith and credit of the United States hostage in a political tantrum.
Well, it's partially the media. It's partially larger economic and social forces in the society that have been going on since about 1970. I would say that's about the point where jobs started trickling out of the country. You had a tremendous financialization of the economy, which in turn fed this whole notion of politics being for sale. You had profits without production on the part of Wall Street, which became a much, much bigger part of the economy. It was no longer simply the lubrication that made real industry work. It supplanted real manufacturing of tangible goods. And as a result, the middle class has indeed been shafted. They've been downscaled in terms of their material expectations. And it's not at all clear in situations like that historically that they will turn to rational solutions to their problem. Rather, they'll look for otherworldly solutions or try to find scapegoats. And we've seen an awful lot of scapegoating in the past.
Well, if there's no question that the financialization of our economy is moving apace. It's over 50% now, and it's unsustainable in the long run that you have an economy run by people who only extract wealth and don't create wealth, and they own our politics. Clearly, you mentioned Geithner. I think the reason he's no different from Hank Paulson is that the same people own both of them. And that is the heart of the problem, is the extent to which there isn't much difference between the two parties. But that's not to say that they're the same, right? I mean, I heard that.
They are not the same.
I heard that back in 2000 when people were saying there's no difference between Bush and Gore. Well, for God's sake, Gore was hapless, he may not have. We still may have had 9/11, but we wouldn't have the response to 9/11. We wouldn't have the Iraq War. We wouldn't have the 2008 crash. I mean, we got to. You can keep two thoughts in your mind, can't you, Mike? On the one hand,
On the one hand,
both parties are owned by the special interests, but on the other hand, one is worse than the other.
Well, I would say that the Democrats are rather feckless. They're shamefaced about taking money from corporate America more than the Republicans, who are very enthusiastic because that's part of their ethos. That's the American way. That's the capitalist free market way. That said, they will take the money. On the other hand, they do take a stab at governance, even if the result is sometimes rather mediocre, whereas the Republicans, I have become convinced, particularly since Obama's election, are mainly interested in maximalist obstruction, and if they don't get their way, there's absolutely no possibility of compromise unless they're really backed into a corner and they have no other alternative. That's not the governance we need for a nation of 310 million people that's the most powerful economic country in the world and the most powerful military country in the world. We can't have people running the country, run it like it's a banana republic.
Well, they can't even run it. They can't even decide. I mean, that's why we have the sequester, isn't it? Because they simply couldn't make a deal. And now you got this incredibly blunt instrument, and you've got the so-called fiscal cliff looming. What's your sense of that? I mean, is it a good or a bad thing? At least, finally, the Defense Department may get cut.
That's true, but also they're so fearful of defense being cut because that's one of the main pillars of their ideology, that they may, if not blink, at least kick the can down the road for some sort of short-term extension at the end of the year. I'm not wholly confident in that because, after all, we did have a credit rating downgrade during the debt ceiling crisis, but I'm thinking it's at least a more than likely chance that they will either solve it in some perfunctory fashion or at least get a short-term extension.
Well, Mike, a friend of mine went to up to that big conclave up in Aspen a while back, where the Gulfstream jets were parked wingtip to wingtip.
The great and the good.
Right. And some hedge fund billionaire who's close to Karl Rove and the Republicans said it's a done deal. They're going to win through unlimited money and voter suppression. And it gets me back to the idea that, you know, that the lunatics could take over the asylum. And I'm just astounded at the apathy that's out there in the American electorate. I mean, I understand why they're fed up with politics. It's a disgrace. But, you know, you can't abdicate, can you?
No, one cannot abdicate. And I think that's also a part of the Republican strategy. They have their own little base corralled within their tent, whom they stoke up and energize to go out to the polls. But everyone else, it's just as well for them if they become apathetic and disgusted with politics and stay away from voting, because then that magnifies the importance of the base that remains.
Well, if you combine that with the polling that suggests that Obama, it's a shoo-in for Obama, that's likely to create a kind of complacency as well. So to me, it's a double whammy.
Yes, and we don't know how much the Bradley effect is still working in terms of people saying they'll vote for them when they really won't.
Just explain the Bradley effect in the closing minute here.
The Bradley effect was referring to Tom Bradley, the mayor of Los Angeles, who was supposedly leading in the polls. People said they were voting for him, and then they didn't vote for him.
I see, because he was black.
People can make their own inference about that, but
well, he certainly was black.
Definitely.
God. Oh well, Mark, I thank you for joining us. I mean, I'm glad that you've made this contribution from your vantage point of having been in the House and Senate and senior analyst on the budget committees. I think your book, "The Party Is Over: How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted," is a very valuable contribution to a debate which I hope we begin to have.
Well, I hope we can get back to the party of Eisenhower and, for that matter, Reagan, because we need a viable two-party system of two sane parties.
Well, thank you for joining us, Mike Lofgren.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst in the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, "The Party Is Over: How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted." We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the terrorist group that the Secretary of State took off the terrorist list.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeremiah Gorka, a writer and public policy analyst who specializes in politics and policy of U.S. national and homeland security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research for the United States military. He was the lead author of The Mujahideen Ehaq, in Iraq, a Policy Conundrum. He was also a member of a research team that helped to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and a staffer on the Congressionally Mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission and an attorney with the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremiah Gorka.
Thanks, Ian. I'm really glad to be back.
And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, clearly under an enormous amount of lobbying pressure, decided to remove the MEK from the State Department's list of designated terrorist organizations. It's extraordinary when you look at the list of national security luminaries who weighed on behalf of the MEK, two former CIA directors, James Woolsey and Porter Goss, former head of this FBI, Louis Freeh, former head of Homeland Security under Bush, Tom Ridge, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, President Obama's first National Security Advisor, General James Jones, and then, of course, the journalists who were paid a lot of money, including Carl Bernstein of the Watergate fame and Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and on and on and on, Ed Rendell, Howard Dean. It's been an amazing public relations effort. So where's all this money coming from that are buying up our politicians?
Well, that's the big question, and it'll be interesting to see whether the Treasury Department bothers to continue its investigation after the delisting decision goes through. It will take a little while for it to fully process. But it's the question everyone's wondering. I know when I was visiting Camp Ashraf, which is Mujahideen Ehaq's camp in Iraq in 2007, I heard all sorts of great rumors. I wasn't sure how much of it to believe, but it was interesting that when the group's leader, Mariam Rajavi, was arrested in 2003 in Paris, the police found several million dollars worth of bonds and other types of financial instruments at her Paris headquarters. Saddam Hussein gave them a lot of money back during the Iran-Iraq War and afterwards. But it's exact quantities. I don't know. They have huge access to cash, and there are certainly some wealthy businessmen who are the ones who are at least named as the people actually funding these the lobbyists and officials. They some call them front groups.
Well, years ago, a long time ago, actually, they tried to win me over with glossy propaganda and bribes, etc. So they're fairly ubiquitous. But what worries me about this decision on the part of Secretary Clinton is that it's likely to open the door for congressional funding of the MEK to conduct terrorist attacks inside of Iran, which is what they've been doing. There's a whole slew of bills waiting, right, to fund terrorists. We funded Jandala there for a while until it backfired on the Baluchistan side of Iran. So is that your expectation?
Pretty much. It's my expectation and worry. There are far too many people who seem to think that the MEK would be some type of useful ally in Iran, whether it's to conduct violent activities or to provide intelligence or to be some type of democratic organization to promote democracy from within. It's none of those things. It's not a democratic organization. It is a cult group. And if people think it's a good idea to fund a group like this to do acts of violence, I think that's just a mistake, and I worry that we'll end up seeing just a repeat of Ahmed Shalabi with Iraq.
So, Jeremiah Gorka, you went to Camp Ashraf, which is on the border between Iraq and Iran, and just to get a little bit of a brief history, the MEK came out after the Iranian Revolution in 1979. They basically lost out to the Ayatollah, and they've been waging a kind of low-intensity war against the theocratic regime in Tehran. And then during the Iran-Iraq war, they sided with Saddam Hussein, who gave them safe harbor at this Camp Ashraf. And then when the United States invaded Iraq, they were disarmed. And then there's been a lot of pressure to get them moved out of Camp Ashraf to Camp Liberty, where apparently they've basically, most of them have shown up. And the UN is now stuck figuring out what the hell they're going to do with these people. Is that a brief history?
That's pretty much it. They did wage violence against the Shah, and then when they were pushed out during the effort to create the new government after the revolution, they fought violently against the new Islamic Republic, who suppressed the MEK violently back. They went into exile, joined forces with Saddam during the Iran-Iraq War, and in the process lost all of their support in Iran. And so the issue of resettlement is a big one now, because the decision to fight on behalf of Saddam not only ruined their support in Iran, but it's paid negative dividends now, because they worked with the Kurdish with Saddam on behalf. Let me clarify this. They are widely perceived to have fought on behalf of Saddam to suppress the Kurdish and Shia uprisings that followed the 1991 Gulf War. And for that, the majority of the Iraqi population loathes the MEK. Plus, you add the fact that the government of Iraq is close with the government of Iran, which loathes the MEK. And so Iraq, since every government in Iraq since 2003, has been very clear that they want the MEK out. The issue is that they are all Iranian citizens. The only place for them to go would be Iran, but it is illegal to be a member of the MEK in Iran. It's a crime there. Iran has brought an amnesty towards the rank-and-file members of the MEK, should they want to come home and be willing to cut their ties with the group. And some people in the MEK have done that. They've cut ties and gone home. But there are these 3,000-odd folks in who were at Camp Ashraf still, in order to get a resettlement process, to find some other third country for them to go to. UN and company were trying to force the MEK to go to Camp Liberty, just outside of Baghdad, to go through a resettlement process. And the MEK is a very difficult group to work with, and the State Department landed on the delisting as a carrot that would work, and it does seem that was a big player in the decision to take them off the list. Though certainly the lobbying that you mentioned already would have created a political atmosphere in which Secretary Clinton would have felt that was a politically safe move.
Yeah, but surely what's going on here is the fact that the MEK are in effect, a terrorist asset that can be used inside of Iran. The Israelis have used them, apparently, to provide so-called intelligence on Iran's nuclear program, which is suspect in itself. They've supposedly been also involved in the assassinations of, or setting up, or perhaps even conducting the assassinations of a number of Iranian scientists, etc. It seems I find it inescapable to assume that what we're talking about here is an asset which is, you know, could seriously create blowback and it could backfire. But that's my assumption. We're not helping these people out for any other reason, are we?
Well, it's hard to disaggregate all of this, and I'm currently trying to finish writing a piece for the American Prospect that kind of breaks it all down as I see it. I think there are lots of people in the government, in the military and in the civilian government, who see the MEK as a potential asset, a useful proxy, or at the least like bullet catchers, which is kind of a cold-blooded way of thinking about it. There are others who think that the MEK is absolutely useless, that their intelligence that they provide is either no good or stuff that we already knew, who think that they are, or in fact know that they are a cult group, that is untrustworthy and not worth using. Even during the Bush administration, people were of mixed opinions, and it kind of depended on who was actually making decisions, and even among decision makers, people were split on it. So this is why I have a hard time thinking that this is sort of a clear decision along those lines, because some people think they're useful and some people don't. The State Department has, for years, really wanted the MEK issue off of their plate. So there's a sort of bureaucratic element of this that is, I think, often kind of missed. But I know when I was interviewing State Department officials, when I was at the RAND Corporation and did the research for my RAND report, that was one of the it was sort of an atmospheric issue. The State Department wanted this off of their plate, and so this is probably a means of doing that. And then there are a couple other things that are factors. One is that the State Department had only about another week to make its decision to keep or keep the MEK on the list or remove it before a federal court was going to remove it automatically on its own. So there was sort of a timing pressure. And there is an interesting legal issue to the extent that the law was determinative here. The Foreign Terrorist Organization law, which is the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, it lays out requirements for what counts as a group that could be listed as a foreign terrorist organization. And one of the interesting things about it is that it does allow a group to try to get off of the list if it can show that circumstances have changed. Mm-hmm. And
well, we're pretty much out of time.
Sorry.
But thank you so much for joining us, Jeremiah, and sharing your firsthand experience with the MEK.
Sure. Thanks so much, James, for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeremiah Gorka, writer and public policy analyst who specializes in the politics and policy of U.S. national and homeland security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research for the U.S. military. He was a lead author of the Mujahideen Haq in Iraq, a policy conundrum. He was also a member of the research team that helped end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a staffer on the congressionally mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission, and an attorney with the United States Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how Bibi Netanyahu has already crossed a couple of red lines interfering in U.S. domestic politics as he tries to drag the U.S. into another unnecessary war.
Now there's a woman on my block just sits there facing the hill saying, who's gonna take away? Who's gonna take away? Who's gonna take away? Now he's helping for destruction. Let's say it again.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Desch, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame and a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study. He's a member of the editorial board and associate editor of International Security and served as editor-in-chief of Security Studies. Before joining the faculty at Notre Dame, Professor Desch was a founding director of the Scowcroft Institute for International Affairs, and he was the first holder of the Robert M. Gates Chair in Intelligence and National Security Decision-Making at the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. He has an article at Foreign Affairs, Bibi's Chutzpah, The Prime Minister Crosses a Red Line. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Desch.
Glad to be here.
And we don't know whether the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, is going to cross the ultimate red line before the elections, as he often has in effect, threatened to do since you've worked with Brent Scowcroft and Robert Gates. I'm sure you're aware of the study that Brent Scowcroft and Brzezinski and Tom Pickering and a group of fairly stellar U.S. national security officials.
It was a cast of thousands.
Right. Well, they put this study together, the cost-benefit analysis of what a strike on Iran would mean. My understanding from that group is that they're not entirely sure that Netanyahu's not going to strike Iran before the elections.
Yeah, I think that there is good reason to be concerned because, Netanyahu is continually making threatening noise, and it seems, highly likely that, he's going to take some action at some point, whether it's before the election or not. I don't know at this point, but it is quite worrisome.
Well, as you've pointed out, though, in your article in Foreign Affairs, Michael Desch, he has already inserted himself in the United States elections. I mean, you could argue that it's no question that the biggest donor so far to Mitt Romney's campaign is Sheldon Adelson, who is undeniably incredibly close to Netanyahu, having actually established a newspaper in Israel entirely devoted to promoting Netanyahu and his policies. This newspaper has become so successful because it's given away free that it's pretty much put a very storied Israeli newspaper out of business. That's not concrete proof. And then you can add to that that John McLaughlin, a former Likud official, is running a PAC down in Florida that is running ads against Obama, suggesting he's thrown Israel under the bus. And there's no question that they are reflecting Netanyahu's views.
Right. Well, as you said, there are really two red lines out there. One is the red line of whether Israel attacks Iran, but the other red line is getting deeply involved in American domestic politics. And Netanyahu hasn't yet crossed the first, but in my opinion, he's well over the second.
So does this make other Israeli officials nervous? I noticed that the leader of the opposition in the Knesset the other day said, to Netanyahu, are you determined to take down the Ahmadinejad government or the Obama government?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the debate in the United States really glosses over how polarized things are in Israel on the whole question of how to deal with Iran and also Prime Minister Netanyahu's, willingness really to push the edge of the envelope. And it's not just the opposition. You have, a raft of retired generals and, former senior intelligence people who are, coming out quite strongly against Netanyahu's sort of apocalyptic rhetoric. And you've also got a lot of concern, and this is really, one of the big issues in Israel. No Israeli prime minister can be seen to be threatening the relationship with the United States. And I think since Yitzhak Shamir and the loan guarantees in 1992, you haven't seen anybody go as far over the line as Netanyahu has. And this makes lots of Israelis nervous. And it's also making a lot of Israel supporters in the United States quite uncomfortable as well. Hence the letter from California Senator Barbara Boxer, very pointedly reminding Netanyahu of all the United States does for Israel, including the Obama administration in that.
Well, Michael Desch, again, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame and a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study. He's a member of the editorial board and associate editor of International Security and served as editor-in-chief of Security Studies. He has an article at Foreign Affairs, BB's Chutzpah, The Prime Minister Crosses a Red Line. Well, just following Barbara Boxer's letter to Bibi Netanyahu, let's talk a little bit about what the United States does do for Israel. They've provided more than $160 billion in bilateral aid since 1948, most of it's military. 60% of all U.S. aid to foreign militaries goes to Israel, which constitutes about 20% of Israel's annual military spending. And the U.S. has, the last few presidents have gone over overboard, if you will, in guaranteeing Israel's security. And on top of all of this largesse, in 2007, George W. Bush made a 10-year commitment to provide $30 billion in military aid to Israel, which Obama has continued to do. And the United States has just deployed its most advanced X-band radar system, which is manned by U.S. personnel in Israel, which would pick up, I think, if a dove takes off in Tehran, I think they can see it, you know.
Well, it hardly sounds like we're throwing Israel under the bus, and yet you wouldn't know that listening to Governor Romney or seeing these ads in Florida.
So what do you think Obama can do about this, since he's on the receiving end of what's essentially the big lie, that he's thrown Israel under the bus when he's done everything he can short of go to war? And, you know, we've already had an unnecessary undeclared war against Iraq, and you don't have to be a genius to notice that Iran won the Iraq war. I mean, we can't even get the Iraqis, who we put in power, to stop the overflight of Iranian aircraft going into Syria supplying the Assad regime. So, you know, if that's the neoconservative idea of a necessary war, another necessary war will put us out of business, won't it?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, there is nobody in the national security community that thinks that a military strike against Iran is anything other than a stopgap. And clearly the American public has little stomach for a third major war in the Islamic world. So, apropos of your question, Ian, President Obama has to walk something of a fine line. I think he does have to respond to the throwing Israel under the bus charge, and surrogates like Senator Boxer, I think, can do that very effectively. On the other hand, I don't think he wants to give away the store. We don't want to be in a position where even a unilateral Israeli strike drags us into a conflict. And likewise, we don't want to paint ourselves into a corner in terms of hewing so closely to the Likud line on issues in the Middle East. And I think a lot of the crisis that is in Netanyahu's mind is not just about the development of the Iranian nuclear program, but it's also thinking ahead. If President Obama is elected to a second term, and when he no longer has the constraints of re-election, and when he's thinking very much about his legacy, a big legacy act would be to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and establish a Palestinian state. And I'm sure that in the back of Netanyahu and a lot of his coalition members' minds is a concern that if it was that hard to deal with Obama facing re-election, what happens if he wins?
Well, it would seem, Michael Desch, that there's a fairly transparent tactic going on here on Netanyahu's part, which is to change the subject from the Palestinians to Iran. And he's effectively done that. Here we are talking about a possible strike on Iran, and frankly, that's been pretty much obsessing the Israeli press for the last year. So the Palestinians are almost invisible. I noticed that the new Egyptian leader in a New York Times interview on Sunday, ahead of his trip to the UN, where he's expected to give a speech, that he's calling for fair and equitable treatment of the Palestinians. So, and one assumes that he's got a certain amount of leverage over Israel, given the treaty and how unpopular it is in Egypt. Do you think that that there's going to be a fairly concerted pressure here from Egypt, not to mention the United States?
Yeah, when you think back of the remarkable record of the Egyptians since 1979 in holding up their end of the Camp David Accords in the face of things like the First Lebanon War and the two Intifadas and the Second Lebanon War and the Gaza incursion, you know, the Israelis have really enjoyed a lot of security on that southern flank, which, you know, previously had been the main threat that they faced. And that was a function of the fact that there was a pro-American government in power that was, pliable, and the United States was willing to push them to maintain the treaty. The Morsi government has drawn a line in the sand, as it were, on a number of issues, and one of the issues is the one you pointed to, the unfinished business of the Camp David Accords. I also think that, President Obama, in his heart of hearts, independent of what the Egyptians would like on this score, would also love to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and produce a Palestinian state.
Well, it's actually in the Camp David Accords, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and it's been reiterated by every presidential administration, including that of George W. Bush, since then.
So, meanwhile, the settlements are growing apace, and now you have in Europe and in some circles of the American left this idea of a one-state solution, which I can't quite get my head around. It seems sort of soporific, but there's a lot of pressure basically saying that this process, this so-called peace process, is not about peace. It's about a process. And
the eternal process.
Yeah, and you get the impression that most people are starting to figure out that the Likud, in particular, aren't entirely serious about peace.
I think not entirely serious is an understatement. I think, you know, Likud and the larger, Greater Israel coalition that undergirds the Netanyahu government, rejects the two-state solution. And ironically, de facto, what the status quo is producing is a one-state solution. Now, I guess I'm with you. Maybe I'm an old dinosaur, but, you know, my view is that the only long-term settlement that ensures stability in the region and also ensures that Israel remains a democratic and a Jewish state is a two-state solution with, a viable Palestinian state for the Palestinians. But the Greater Israel crowd is so committed or beholden to the settlement enterprise they're in effect rejecting the two-state solution and continuing with policies that are going to ultimately result in the one-state solution. So ironically, you have, the left and the right sort of converging on a policy that down the road is going to be a disaster.
And Michael Desch, it's not unfair to tie Mitt Romney to the right-wing Israeli position here, because he's made it pretty clear, particularly in that surreptitious tape from the fundraiser down in Florida in May, that he pretty much dismisses the Palestinians, that they're not serious about peace, which is another way to saying that buying into the idea that they're just a bunch of terrorists.
Right. Well, I think that there are, two things. One, the issue that's getting a lot of attention is Netanyahu's longstanding personal relationship with former Governor Romney. And I think that matters a little bit. But I think the bigger issue has been the development since the late 1970s of larger political links between the Republican Party and Likud and, the Greater Israel movement over there in general. And there are a couple of elements to that. One is the rise of evangelical Protestantism, and particularly those evangelicals who are Christian Zionists, who believe that support for Israel, right or wrong, can be justified by Scripture. The other thing is there's this whole transnational network of political activists both in international politics or, you know, foreign policy and defense and the neoconservatives, but also in domestic politics, who are going back and forth between Israel and Likud and the United States and the Republican Party that represent some organic links between these two movements. And I think the net effect is that the Republican Party has become, you know, increasingly in lockstep, you know, with the Israeli right.
Well, just in closing, Michael Desch, isn't there also this small group of very wealthy Jewish American donors? Sheldon Adelson, we've mentioned before, but he's prominent, but there's a fellow out here that owns some casinos, Moskovitz, who spends a lot of money on West Bank settlements, the family that own Häagen-Dazs ice cream, and a bunch of other wealthy American Jewish American business people are really investing a ton of money. I mean, it's not just the Christian Zionists. It's some of the biggest donors in Romney's race, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are a lot of money bags, you know, who are very influential in both parties, and I think that there are some, you know, epitomized by Sheldon Adelson, who feel very strongly on the Israel issue. And I think that does make a difference, but I wouldn't overstate it. You know, I think, you know, the fact of the matter is most American Jews remain much more inclined towards the Democratic Party. And I think that they're more moderate on issues of U.S.-Israel relations than the Adelsons and the Moskowitzes of the world are. But nonetheless, if you can donate $100 million to a campaign, you get a seat at the table. There's no denying that.
Of course, the point to remember here is the extent to which the American Jewish community is largely liberal and votes Democratic, and that this is a minority position, but it's one that's backed up by a ton of money and by a lot of political activism.
Right. The thing, you know, I think that's important, but I think it's important as part of the larger organic connections between, you know, the Republican Party or elements of the Republican Party and Likud and other right-wing political movements in Israel. So the net effect of all these things is mutually reinforcing, you know, to the extent that you know, the position that General Scowcroft and the first President Bush took, you know, about the loan guarantees and the Madrid process, you know, which was the center of gravity, I think, in the foreign policy establishment, you know, 20 years ago, is now a fringe position within the Republican Party and a sort of reflexive, you know, anything the current government of Israel wants is okay by me position now unfortunately defines the center of gravity among Republicans.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Desch.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Desch. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame and a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study. He's a member of the editorial board and associate editor of International Security and served as editor-in-chief of Security Studies. Before joining the faculty at Notre Dame, Professor Desch was the founding director of the Scowcroft Institute for International Affairs and was the first holder of the Robert M. Gates Chair in Intelligence and National Security Decision-Making at the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. He has an article at Foreign Affairs, Bibi's Chutzpah, the Prime Minister Crosses a Red Line. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time